And I've had a thesis for a long time, and that is this. I'm going to preface this with a little thesis, and that is that a true iconoclast. Now, there are many people who seem to be iconoclastic at any given time in history, but they're not truly an iconoclast. Generally, we call an iconoclast somebody who we think is against the bad guys. You know, somebody we consider the bad guys. That's called an iconoclast, like poor old Mort Saul. He's about as iconoclastic as my Aunt Clara, who was always mad at the president. But so really, a true iconoclast. Now, this is Shepard's thesis. A true iconoclast hits upon something very basic, so basic that he is perennially, let's say, outside of the fold. In other words, if you read an iconoclast who wrote 2,000 years ago, he'll make you mad. That's a true iconoclast, really. If you read, for example, a lot of Jonathan Swift, he really bugs you right today, reading them, you know? He really does. Now, I'm going to read something to you. And this is an iconoclast. Now, I won't even tell you when it was written, but I'll warn you, he'll get you bugged. Already, the opening line. And I might point out that this writer's been dead for some time. So that's a clue. It is not a current writer at all. Half the sorrows of the world, I suppose. I want you to listen carefully to this, because this is during an election time. We're about to have an election. And this is what he's writing about. Half the sorrows of the world, I suppose, are caused by making false assumptions. If the truth were only easier to ascertain, the remedy for them would consist simply of ascertaining it and accepting it. This business, alas, is usually impossible. But fortunately, not always. Now and then, by some occult process, half rational and half instinctive, the truth gets itself found out, and an ancient false assumption goes overboard. I point in the field of the social relations to one which afflicted the human race for millenniums, that one to which credited the reverend clergy with a mysterious wisdom and awful powers. Obviously, it has ceased to trouble all the superior varieties of men. It may survive in those remote marches where human beings go to bed with the cows, but certainly it has vanished from the cities. Asphalt and the apostolic succession, indeed, seem to be irreconcilable enemies. I can think of no clergyman in any great American city today whose public dignity and influence are much above those of an ordinary Class One Babbitt. It is hard for even the most diligent and passionate of the ancient order to get upon the first pages of the newspapers. He must make a clown show, discreditable to his fraying cloth, or he must blush unseen. When bishops began launching thunderbolts against heretics, the towns today do not tremble. They laugh. When elders denounce sin, sin only grows more popular. Imagine a city man greeting a notice from the ordinary of his diocese that he has been excommunicated. It would trouble him far less, I venture, than his morning newspaper. The reason for all of this is not hard to find. All the superior varieties of men, and even the lowest varieties of city workmen, are at least superior to peasants, have simply rid themselves of their old belief in devils. Hell no longer affrights and palsies them, and so the magic of those who profess to save them from it no longer impresses them. That profession, I believe, was bogus, and its acceptance was therefore a false assumption. Being so, it made men unhappy. Getting rid of it has delivered them. They are no longer susceptible to ecclesiastical alarms and extortions. Ergo, they sleep and eat better. Just think of what life must have been under such princes of damnation as Cotton Mather, with even bartenders and metaphysicians believing in them. And then compare it to life under Bishop Manning and the Reverend Dr. John Roach Straton, with only a few half-wits believing in them. Or turn to the backwoods of the Republic, where the devil is still feared, and with him his confessional and professional exterminators. In the country towns, the clergy are still almost as influential as they were back in Cotton Mather's day. And there, as everyone knows, they remain public nuisances, and civilized life is almost impossible. In such Neolithic regions, life can go on without their consent. On penalty of no life can go on without their consent. On penalty of anathema and hellfire. As a result, nothing goes on that is worth recording. It is this survival of sacerdotal authority, I begin to believe, and not hookworm, malaria, or the event of April 9th, 1865, that is chiefly responsible for the cultural paralysis of the late Confederate states. The South lacks big cities. It is run by its country towns. And in every country town, there is some Baptist mullah who rules by scaring the peasantry. The false assumption that his pretensions are sound, that he can actually bind and loose, that contumacy to him is a variety of cursing God, this false assumption is what makes the yokel so uneasy, so nervous, and hence so unhappy. If they could throw it off, they would burn far fewer Negroes and sing more songs. If they could be purged of it, they would be rid and purged of Ku Kluxery, too. The cities got rid. You can see this guy writes well. Wait till he gets down to politicians now. I want you to listen very carefully now. We're getting to the nitty-gritty. Now, don't go away. The cities got rid of that false assumption over half a century ago and have been making cultural progress ever since. Somewhat later, they got rid of its brother, to wit, respect for government, and in particular, respect for its visible agents, the police. That respect, traditional and hence irrational, had been for years an increasingly unpleasant collision with a great body of obvious facts. The police, by assumption, austere and almost sacrosanct, were gradually discovered to be in reality just like anyone else, some good, some bad, a pack of rogues, but little removed, save by superior impudence and enterprise, from the cutthroats and purse snatchers that they were set to catch. When a few decades ago the American people, at least in the big cities, began to accept them frankly for what they were, when the old false assumptions of their integrity and public usefulness were quietly abandoned, then there was more public happiness. People no longer were astonished when policemen were caught in evil doing. Indignation abated, and with it, its pains. If before that time, the corps of prohibition enforcement officers, in other words, a corps of undistinguished scoundrels with badges, had been launched upon the populace, there would have been a great roar of wrath and anger. People who would have felt themselves put upon. But instead, they met the new onslaught calmly and even smilingly and made jokes about it. Today, no one is indignant over the fact that the extortions of these new people increased the cost of potable alcohol. The false assumption that the police are altruistic agents of a benevolent state has been replaced by a sound assumption that they are just like us, gentlemen engaged, like the rest of us, in finding meat and raiment for their families and in laying up funds to buy liberty bonds for the next war to end war. This is human progress, for it increases human happiness. Okay. So much for the evidence. Here's where he gets down to the nitty-gritty, and this is going to make a lot of you mad. So much for the evidence. The deduction I propose to make from it is simply this, that a like increase would follow in happiness if the American people could only rid themselves of another and worse false assumption that still rides with them, one that corrupts all their thinking about the great business of politics and vastly augments their discontent and unhappiness. The assumption, that is, that politicians are divided into two classes, and that one of these classes is made up of good ones. I need not argue, I hope. Do you hear that line? That everybody believes there's two groups of politicians, good guys and bad guys. Of course, they're voting for the good ones. He says, I need not argue, I hope, that this assumption is almost universally held among us. Our whole politics, indeed, is based upon it and has been based upon it since the earliest days. What is any political campaign save a concerted effort to turn out a set of politicians who are admittedly bad and put in a set who are thought to be better? The former assumption, I believe, is always sound. The latter is just as certainly false. For if experience teaches us anything at all, it teaches us this, that a good politician is quite as unthinkable as an honest burglar. His very existence, indeed, is a standing subversion of the public good in every rational sense, He is not one who serves the commonweal. He is simply one who lives upon the commonweal. It is to the interest of all the rest of us to hold down his powers to an irreducible minimum and to reduce his compensation almost to nothing. It is his interest to augment his powers at all hazards and to make his compensation all the traffic will bear. To argue that these aims are identical is to argue palpable nonsense. The politician, at his ideal best, never even remotely approximated in practice, of course, is a necessary evil. At his worst, he is an almost intolerable nuisance. Now, what I contend is simply that he would be measurably less a nuisance if we got rid of our old false assumption about him and regarded him in the cold light of fact. At once, I believe, two-thirds of his obnoxiousness would vanish. He would remain a nuisance, but he would cease to be a swindler. The injury of having to pay freight on him would cease to be complicated by the insult of being rooked. It is the insult and not the injury that makes the deeper wounds and causes the greater permanent damage to the national psyche. All of us have been trained since infancy, for example, in putting up with necessary evils, plainly recognized as evils. We know, for example, that the young of the human species commonly smell badly, that garbage men, bootblacks, and messenger boys commonly smell worse. Now, these facts are not agreeable, but they remain tolerable because they are universally assumed, because there's no sense of having been tricked and cozened in their perennial discovery. But try to imagine how distressing fatherhood would become if prospective fathers were all taught that the human infant radiates an aroma like the rose, if the truth came constantly as a surprise. Each fresh victim of deception would feel that he's been basely swindled and that his own child was somehow bogus. Not infrequently, I suppose, he would be tempted to make away with it in some quiet manner and have another, only to be shocked again. That procedure would be idiotic, of course. Admittedly, yet it's exactly the one we follow in politics. At each election, we vote in a new set of politicians, insanely assuming that they are better than the set turned out. And at each election, we are, as they say in the motherland, done in. Of late, now listen, it sounds like it was written yesterday. This is WOR New York. Of late, the fraud has become so gross that the plain people begin to show a great restlessness under it. Like animals in a cage, they trot from one corner to another, endlessly seeking a way out. If the Democrats win one year, it's a pretty sure sign that they will lose the next year. State after state becomes doubtful, pivotal, skittish. Even the solid South has begun to break. In the cities, it is still worse. An evil circle is formed. First, the poor taxpayers, robbed by the politicians of one great party, and then by those of the other, turn to a group of freelance rogues in the middle ground, so-called nonpartisan candidates, liberals, reformers, or whatnot. The name is unimportant. They're always considered to be independent. Then, flayed and pillaged by these gentry, as they never were by the old-time professionals, they go back in despair to the latter and are flayed and pillaged again. Back to Tammany. Tammany reigns in New York because the Mitchell outfit, the great reformers, were found to be intolerable in practice. In other words, the reformers were found to be even worse than the professionals. Is the fact surprising? Why should it be? Reformers and professionals are alike. They're politicians in search of jobs. Both are trying to get in on the big trough. Neither ever has any other motive underneath all the yelling and all the hollering. If any genuinely honest and altruistic politician had come to the surface in my time, I'd have heard of him. For I've always frequented newspaper offices, and in a newspaper office, the news of such a peerless marvel would cause a dreadful tumult. I can recall no such tumult. The unanimous opinion of all the journalists that I know, excluding a few liberals who are obviously somewhat balmy, they all believe, for example, that the late war would end war, is that since the days of the national tours and motans, no politician who was not out for himself, and for himself alone, ultimately, has ever drawn the breath of life. The gradual disintegration of liberalism among us, in fact, offers an excellent proof of the truth of my thesis. The liberals have come to grief by fooling their customers not merely once too often, but 100 times too often, over and over again, they've trotted out some new hero, usually from the great open spaces such as Kansas or the Dakotas, only to see him taken in the immemorial malpractices within 10 days. Their graveyard, indeed, is filled with cracked and upset headstones, many covered with ribald pencilings. Every time there's a scandal in the grand manner, the liberals lose as much general offices as either the Democrats, the Republicans, or even the hold-the-liners. Of late, racked beyond endurance by such catastrophes at home, they have gone abroad for their principal heroes, losing humor as well as hope. They now praise foreign politicians, many of whom, if they were in an American state, would not only be in the calaboose, but often actually in the death house. But this absurdity is only an offshoot of a deeper one. Their primary error lays in making the false assumption that some politicians are better than others. This error they share with the whole American people. I propose that it be renounced, and contend that its renunciation would greatly rationalize and improve our politics. I do not argue that there would be any improvement in our politicians. On the contrary, I believe that they would remain substantially as they are today and perhaps even grow worse. But what I do argue is that recognizing them frankly for what they are would instantly and automatically dissipate the indignation caused by their present abominations, and that the disappearance of this indignation would promote the public contentment and happiness. Under my scheme, there would be no more false assumptions and no more false hopes, and hence no more painful surprises, no more bitter resentment of fraud, no more despair. Politicians, insofar as they remain necessary, would be kept at work, but not with any insane notion that they're archangels. Their rascality would be assumed and discounted, as the rascality of the police is now assumed and discounted. Machinery would be gradually developed to limit it and counteract it. In the end, it might be utilized in some publicly profitable manner, as the insensitiveness to filth of garbage men is now utilized, as the reverence of the clergy for capitalism is now utilized. The results, perhaps, would be a world no better than the present one, but at least a world more intelligent. Now, for all of this, I sincerely hope that no one will mistake me for one who shares the indignation I have spoken of. That is, for one who believes that politicians can be made good and cherishes a fond scheme for making them so. I believe nothing of the sort. On the contrary, I'm convinced that the art and mystery they practice is essentially and incurably antisocial, that they must remain irreconcilable enemies of the common weal until the end of time. But I maintain that this fact in itself is not a bar to their employment. They are necessary. There are, under Christian civilizations, many necessary offices that demand the possession of antisocial talents. A professional soldier, regarded realistically, is actually much worse than a professional politician, for he is a professional murderer, whereas the politician is only a professional sharper and sneak thief. A clergyman, too, begins to sneak and to shrink and shrivel on analysis. The work he does in the world is basically almost indistinguishable from that of an astrologer, a witch doctor, or a fortune teller. He pretends falsely that he can get sinners out of hell and collects money from them on that promise, tacit or express. If he had to go before a jury with that pretension, it would probably go hard with him. But we do not send him before a jury. We grant him his hocus-pocus on the ground that it is necessary to his office, and that his officer is necessary to civilization, so-called. I pass over the journalists delicately. The time has not come yet to turn state's evidence. Suffice it to say that he, too, would probably wither under a stiff cross-examination. If he is no murderer, like the soldier, then he is at least a sharper and swindler, like the politician. What I plead for, if I may borrow a term in disrepute, is simply realpolitik. In other words, realism in politics. I can imagine a political campaign purged of all the current false assumptions and false pretenses, a campaign in which on election day the voters went to the polls clearly informed that the choice between them was not between an angel and a devil, a good man and a bad man, an altruist or a go-getter, but between two frank go-getters who want to get elected, the one perhaps excelling at beautiful and nonsensical words and the other at silent and prehensile deeds. The one a Chautauqua orator, and the other a porch climber. There would be in that choice something candid, something free and exhilarating, something exciting. Buncombe would be adjourned. The voter would make a selection in the full knowledge of all the facts, as he makes a selection between two heads of cabbage, or two evening newspapers, or two brands of chewing tobacco. Today, he chooses his rulers as he buys bootleg whiskey, never knowing precisely what he is getting, only certain that it is not what it pretends to be. The scotch may turn out to be wood alcohol, or it may turn out to be gasoline. In either case, it is not scotch. How much better if it were plainly labeled, for wood alcohol and gasoline both have their uses, higher uses indeed than scotch. The danger is that the swindled and poisoned consumer, despairing of ever avoiding them when he doesn't want them, may prohibit them even when he does want them, and actually enforce his own prohibition. The danger is, then, that the hopeless voter, forever victimized by his false assumption about politicians, may in the end gather such ferocious indignation that he will abolish them teetotally and at one insane swoop, and so cause government by the people, for the people, and with the people to perish from the earth.